going to bring the Health and Human Service Policy Committee to order. Can we please take our seats and thank you. So we do have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Albright moves the minutes from March the 4th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes have been approved from March the 4th. Thank you. Okay, members, we have a big agenda today, a long agenda today, and we're going to try to get through as much as possible, as try to get through as many bills as possible during this afternoon. But we're going to take a recess before we take up House File 3485, because we have some advocates who wanted to be present for that portion of the agenda, and they require some special assistance. So we will end at 4:15, unless we get through sooner than that. And then we will recess, switch rooms, and come back at 6 o'clock to reconvene in room 120 of the Capitol to finish our business up for the day. All right? Okay. So let's start by hearing 3359. Moeller, Representative Moeller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. So the chair moves House File 3359 and that it be recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Moeller, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So House File 3359, although long, is a technical bill. Last year, I authored a bill that was signed into a law, and it allowed people using consumer-directed community supports to share services. And in that bill, there was an instruction to the reviser to codify laws governing consumer-directed community supports during this session. So members, staff worked very hard over the interim to put this bill together, and this is the result. I will tell you that it has a Senate companion, and that companion is moving in the Senate. And I believe staff is able to answer questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank you. So is there anyone else? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3359? Okay. Any discussion from members? Well, there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 3359 be recommended for placement on a general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 3359 is recommended to be placed on a general register. Thank you. So we're going to move on to your next bill, House File 3868. The chair moves that House File 4868 be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. Representative Moeller, do you have an author's amendment?
That's correct, Madam Chair. It's the A1 amendment.
Thank you. So the chair moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Moeller, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So House File 3868, as amended, makes changes to the background study process for guardians and conservators, streamlining the process to decrease the delays that currently happen due to the frequency of the background checks. And as my testifier will explain, these delays put vulnerable adults at risk. This bill also creates some guardrails by requiring different professional licensing agencies, for example, the Lawyers Responsibility Board, the Board of Social Work, and many others, to provide the commissioner with quarterly lists of new sanctions issued by the agency. It requires the commissioner to review licensing agency databases at least once every 4 months to determine if there's any new disciplinary action. This bill also has a Senate companion, and it has passed the Senate Judiciary Committee. And with me, Madam Chair, is a testifier to explain the bill in a little more detail.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Charles Singer. I'm an attorney in private practice. I have been a practicing attorney for 40 years. the last 28 years as a solo practitioner. I've 80% of my, can you hear me?
Yes.
80% of my practice is in the guardianship and conservatorship area. I probably filed 2,000 petitions over my career. I am here to talk about one narrow aspect of this amendment, and that is changing the background checks back to 5 years from 2 years. So the statute required criminal background checks for guardians every 5 years until 2013, when an amendment changed it to every 2 years. As a result, the Department of Human Services has had a lot more work with insufficient funds to carry out their required duties with regard to these background checks. The background checks, which are required to be completed within 30 days, often take 60 days or longer. There are unintended consequences to these delays. When a guardian can't get appointed in a timely manner, vulnerable adults are put at risk. Medical decisions can't be made, nor can a person's place of abode be changed. Medical assistance applications are often delayed, which can result in a nursing home losing several months of reimbursement. The requirement of completing the background check every 2 years puts a heavy burden on the clerks of the probate court and DHS personnel. Requiring court and state personnel to process all these background checks costs time and money. Reminders are sent out to guardians who do not submit their consents. And I got 25 notices to file or appear just in 1 month. And that happens when the guardians do not submit their consents in a timely manner. Sometimes an order to show cause is required, which involves sheriffs having to personally serve these orders. And a special burden is placed on professional guardians who may have 50 or more clients. They have to file and submit affidavits of prior background in each file, indicating they've cleared the background check in the last 2 years. So to correct this logjam in the guardianship appointment process, I would urge you to change the background checks back to once every 5 years.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify at 13668? Okay. Any discussion from members? All right. There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 3868, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3868, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary and Finance Committee. Thank you so much, Representative Moeller. No. Is Representative Richardson in the audience? Okay. So we will go to House File 3159. Okay. The chair moves that House File 3159 be recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Richardson, I see you have an author's amendment. So I will move the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and Representative Richardson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment makes some non-substantive changes to Section 260C, 0.219 by adding some subdivisions and headers for readability and organization. But the substance of House File 3159 would require a responsible social service agency to coordinate a prenatal alcohol exposure screening within 45 days after the removal of a child from their home. Research over the past 50 years has clarified the impact of prenatal alcohol exposure, which can result in a brain injury for which there currently is no cure. Early identification of developmental disabilities, including fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, is critical to the well-being of children and their families. When we have early identification of a brain injury associated with prenatal alcohol exposure and appropriate supports are in place, we can reduce secondary issues and challenges. The Minnesota Department of Health has funds dedicated to a statewide organization that focuses solely on the prevention of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and support for families who are impacted, which is currently known as Proof Alliance. With its dedicated appropriation, Proof would be required to provide technical assistance, support, and training to social service agencies to meet with the prenatal alcohol screening requirements of the bill. Therefore, there's no fiscal note associated with this bill. In addition, Proof Alliance coordinates a consortium of FASD diagnostic clinics across the state and will be able to provide resources and supports for FASD diagnostic assessments for children who screen positive for prenatal alcohol exposure. Today, I have the Executive Director of Proof Alliance, Sarah Masselt, to share briefly about the bill.
All right, well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Masselt, Executive Director of Proof Alliance, formerly the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder. We know children who are entering foster care are at greater risk of prenatal exposure to alcohol. Prenatal exposure to alcohol causes fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. When a child is placed in foster care, we believe it is essential that the foster care providers understand the implications of this exposure, how it may impact the child, and how to provide the best support. Here in Minnesota, we have demonstrated a deep commitment to preventing prenatal exposure to alcohol because, as Representative Richardson says, we know this exposure causes permanent brain injury and can leave the child with cognitive impairments, learning disabilities, and physical defects. It is vital we identify those children as soon as possible and provide appropriate interventions and services in order to improve outcomes, keep children in school and out of the juvenile justice system. Conservatively, research and our experience in Hennepin County tells us that 30% of children in foster care have this exposure. The screening should be done universally in order to ensure the best outcomes. So Proof Alliance, as previously stated by Representative Richardson, will continue to work collaboratively with the counties, the Minnesota Department of Health, and DHS to provide this training to all responsible social service agencies across the state. We appreciate this time and your support of 3159.
All right, thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3159? Okay. Members, have any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Richardson, I want to draw your attention to page 4 of the bill, lines 4.10 and line 4.14, where you use the term responsible. Could you just elaborate? I think I know what you're trying to get at, but I just wanted to verify when you say responsible social services agency, could you just elaborate in terms of what that looks like?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we would be talking about Proof Alliance working directly with the counties. So when there are out-of-home placements that are occurring within that 45-day period, they would be required to do the prenatal screening.
Representative Albright.
Sure. And just a little deeper dive in terms of, do you have agencies or organizations in mind that are capable of doing that this would pertain to?
Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, so Representative Albright, are in terms of when you say that they would be doing this, are you referring to the screening or the diagnostic assessment?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good question, Representative Richardson. What I'm really looking forward to for an answer on is what organizations by name or county agency would pertain to responsible social services agency?
Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So when we're talking about responsible social service agencies, we'd be talking about, for example, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota County would be examples of responsible social service agencies.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, members, any further discussion? All right. So there have been no further discussion. The chair renews her motion. The House File 3159, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Well, The motion prevails, and House File 3159, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you. All right, Representative Richardson. We're going to move on to House File 3093. The chair moves that House File 3093 be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. You have an office amendment, so I would like to move the DE1 office amendment. But before we vote on that, Ms. Carquist has a technical oral amendment for us that simply updates the bill title to reflect the changes made by the DE1 amendment. So, Ms. Carquist?
Madam Chair and members, so the change is on page 4, line 16. Delete everything after bias, and page 4, line 17, delete hemorrhage.
We are on the 3093. Along with the it's not the right one. Okay.
Let's skip to the next.
Okay. We have the.
Sorry.
Thank you for catching that.
Well, that was exciting.
We have the wrong amendment in the package. Okay. So, Representative.
No, it's just a different coded amendment.
Richardson, would you mind? We're going to lay this on the table for a moment while we go get the correct amendment, and we're going to move on to the next bill. Is Representative Cantrell in the audience? Okay. So we're going to move on to Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, I understand you have an author amendment. Would you like to move the bill and the amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DE1, which is an amendment working with, right now we have sober homes in the state of Minnesota, working with MASH and other advocates to make sure that this bill was agreeable to all stakeholders.
Okay. So Representative Edelson moves the DE1. Did that include the DE1 amendments?
Yes, please,
okay,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. So you move the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Representative Edelson, we're going to move back again to have you move your bill and the DE1 amendment.
Yes, I would like to move. It's going to be going to Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay. We're going to. Representative Edelson is moving the House File 3537 bill and to be re-referred to
Health and Human Service Finance Division.
Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Thank you. Okay.
Now we're moving on.
So, Representative, and I also would like to, you also removed the DE1 author's amendment already. And we already voted on that one.
No, Madam Chair, you have to redo that because you didn't have the amendment. You didn't have the bill.
We don't have the amendment in front of us, do we?
The bill.
The bill.
You didn't have the bill before you moved the amendment. We have to move the amendment again.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I move that House File 3537 be recommended for re-referral to HHS Finance. And then we can move the amendment, is that correct?
Then also move the DE1 office amendment. So, Representative Edelson moves the DE1 office amendment. Once again, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and Representative Edelson, please present your bill.
As amended.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. All right. House 3537 it's a sober homes provide a place to stay for people in recovery from substance use disorder. These residences are meant to be safe and chemically free homes for people to live in with their peers with similar recovery goals. While there are many quality sober homes providers out there, NAMI Minnesota and advocates have heard complaints about unsanitary conditions, high cost, and people being discharged in the middle of the night following a rule violation. Sober homes are currently unregulated, and there is nowhere for a person to submit a formal complaint to a government agency. I have our testifier, Chris, who's essentially been doing this on his own, so thank you for that. As the sober home model expands, it's time to bring the key stakeholders together and have a conversation about what the oversight of this treatment model looks like going forward. What this bill does is it requires DHS to identify sober home providers in Minnesota, as well as services and supports the home offers, the level of supervision, admission, discharge criteria, any licensure or certification for the facility, any public funding the program receives. It also requires us to identify the aspect of a sober home that potentially require oversight such as admission and discharge criteria, the level of care provided, any connection with other outpatient substance use disorders, standards of health, safety, and supervision of a sober home, identify the types of sober home settings and services that may not require oversight, consider what other states, national organizations, and state organizations like MASH are doing to oversee sober homes, and recommend potential oversight options for sober homes going forward. To accomplish this work, we will be working together, so I'm going to turn it over to, I think, Sue Abderholden from NAMI will be testifying first.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. NAMI did begin to hear complaints about 6 to 9 months ago. Sometimes people were, actually there were some deaths in some facilities, or the family went and it really was not clean and safe for the individual. And as we started looking into it, we realized there really isn't oversight by any government agency unless someone had a board and care home. So we said, well, maybe it's time to look at it. And we did some research and decided that we didn't really know what the answer was. So we thought it was best to actually bring everyone together kind of in the interim to say what should we do, if anything, and come back with some type of agreement among all the different parties. But we thought it was important enough as this area is expanding to really look at it and figure out what steps we should take for the future.
All right. Thank you. So the next testifier, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Sherry Walling. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist here in Minnesota and also in California. I relocated to Minnesota from California about 4 years ago. And I wish I was sitting before you as a professional, but I'm not. I'm sitting before you as a sister. In February of 2017, I got a call that my brother was in the intensive care unit in a hospital in Montana. He experienced failure of multiple organ systems, secondary to essentially almost drinking himself to death. I got on a plane, and I sat by his side for 10 days as he fought for his life. And when he was well enough to leave the hospital, there was nowhere for him to go in Montana. There was no family for him there, and so I brought him back to Minnesota with me. I helped him enroll in an inpatient treatment program here in the Twin Cities. And professionally, I know that Minnesota leads much of the country in its access to high quality care for substance abuse disorders. My brother did well in treatment. It was his first attempt at treatment after years of abuse. He did the work. And eventually, after 9 months in an inpatient program, he graduated. And he got a job as a bike delivery man for Jimmy John's, and he ran the omelet station at the Hotel Minneapolis on the weekends. So all systems or all sort of things pointed to the fact that he was doing well in his recovery. He lived in a sober home during this time, and it was a little bit of a tough situation for him. The stove was broken, the washing machine was broken. He spent his time mostly at work or at my house doing laundry or borrowing my paddleboard, as brothers do. He didn't want to be there at the sober home. He felt like he was the only one serious about treatment. He was worried for his safety. He was worried for his belongings. He kept his cash and his guitar at my house. He would tell me stories about people using while they were in the home. And that was pretty tricky. You can't really tell on people that you live with. There's not actually really anyone to tell when the rules aren't being followed. I've been to the home several times, and it felt pretty unsafe to me as a visitor. After 18 months of sobriety, Dave relapsed. He relapsed the day after our father died, and we were both with him. My dad died of esophageal cancer, and pretty immediately, Dave started to go downhill. He did not do well with his grief. So we had a few months of deep darkness, and then he found his way back to treatment again, once again here in the Twin Cities. Once again, he did well. He benefited from the place to grieve and to put his life back together. And once again, he was discharged to another sober house. This house was horrible right away. He was terrified. The other residents mocked him and taunted him. I'm not really sure exactly what happened to him there. There's some things you don't really tell your sister, but I know that he was scared. He called and he asked to stay with me. And I told him no. That was part of the arrangement that my husband and I had made when we brought him to Minnesota. We have three young children, and we didn't feel like we could have another person living with us. He called my mother. He called the treatment facility that he'd been released from, and there just weren't any options for him. So he scraped together all of the cash that he had, and he bought a train ticket to Montana to return to the place that he'd spent much of his 20s. He got a job, and he thought he had a new start. But it was too much too fast, too much change. There was no community of care outside of a prescription from a psychiatrist. There was no safe place to heal and to grieve. And my brother died by suicide on May 10th, 2019, which is actually 10 months ago today. He died 3 weeks after leaving treatment. And as a family member and as a professional, I want to tell you this is not how this story should go. We've long known that people are most vulnerable during these transitions. They're most vulnerable to relapse and to suicide. And my experience with the sober homes is that they are unsafe and unaccountable. And my brother was scared, and he wasn't granted the dignity of a safe place to sleep or to keep his belongings. We're dumping our most vulnerable people, those who are clinging to whatever shreds of hope they can, into places that are unregulated, unsafe, where bullies rule, and the dignities of physical and emotional safety are denied. No one in this room could thrive in these supposed homes. One of the biggest regrets of my life is that I did not offer him a place to stay in my home. I didn't quite understand how terrible it was for him. It wasn't until I talked to other families with similar experiences that I understood how serious the situation was. I thought, there are homes available, you should be okay in one of them. So I trusted the system of care, and I shouldn't have. And in addition to the pain of losing my tender, blue-eyed, wild soul brother, that's a regret that I will live with for the rest of my life. So I'm asking for your help, that you would do more to ensure that every person has the dignity of a safe place to heal by keeping more attention on the well-being of sober homes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for testifying, and sorry for your loss. To the next testifier, Chris, please introduce yourself for the record.
And Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Chris Edrington. I'm a founding member of the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, as well as the National Alliance of Recovery Residences, a federal or a national organization that oversees the state affiliates like MASH. I helped start MASH in 2008 as a response to a City of St. Paul ordinance to regulate sober, or to study, actually to study sober living homes in Ramsey County. As I said, we've been around since 2008, setting standards, training managers, learning best practices, and we have a lot of information and a lot of experience with running sober homes. They're not all perfect, but most of them, that are the ones that are in MASH, are held to a high standard. And the national organization has just released the set of standards 3.0, which is the most recent, and MASH is adopting them as we speak, like literally this month, We've adopted the previous iterations of those standards. So there is in place quite a bit of infrastructure to self-regulate, so to speak, and oversee sober houses in this state. I think, you know, Minnesota has a legacy of being responsible for responding to addiction. And, you know, the Minnesota model developed in Willmar is what every treatment center still, generally speaking, uses across the country. If you speak to people who know addiction and know the recovery from addiction, the work begins after treatment in the community. And that's what a sober house provides, is that opportunity to engage in the community. And it is messy, it's difficult, it can be very difficult. I myself, a recovering addict, I was a heroin addict for basically the decade of the 90s, and my friends in Boulder said, if you don't go to Minnesota, you're going to die. And so I came to Minnesota, and I'm 21 years sober now. And I attribute it more to the community. I think the responsibility of the sober houses is to engage people in the great sober community, and St. Paul has one, and the Twin Cities has one of the most vibrant populated sober communities in the whole country. And I travel and teach and lecture at treatment centers all over the country, and they all know about St. Paul. So I would like to, we don't have any opposition as the organization of MASH to doing a study. What we would like to do is be part of the conversation. We've done a lot of work for 10 years around how to run a good sober house, and we know what we're doing, and we just want to be part of the conversation going forward.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony, and congratulations on 21 years of sobriety. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3537? Members, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, thank you for bringing this bill forward. My only question, and maybe is a conclusion I've drawn from reading the bill, but by virtue of this task force being created and their work, are you looking to provide back to the legislature almost the creation of a best practices standard, as opposed to more of a identification of what doesn't work, identify what does work? What side are we playing on here?
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Ms. Abderholden actually answer this question, since she's been doing yeoman's work on it.
Okay, thank you. Introduce yourself, just for the record.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, our goal is to really try to figure out what we should do in Minnesota and come back with recommendations. It may be that we want some type of, you know, kind of certification program that people have to meet certain standards, and here's who you would call if you had a problem. But we don't have a, you know, kind of a pre-thought-out solution to the problem yet, because we really feel like we need to dig into it. I do not want to sit there and talk about the problems. I want to talk about solutions. And so NAMI is going to be on this task force, and we will certainly push it in that direction.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you. Dr. Walling, I'm very sorry for your loss. I can only imagine the grief that you must have gone through seeing your brother go through that. You raised an interesting question, though, in terms of kind of the tough love attitude that you took with your brother. And from a medical practitioner or perspective, is there concern about violations of HIPAA or whatever have you, as you might self-report someone, even if a family member, or am I off in the tall grass unnecessarily on this one?
Dr. Walling.
Well, I know that my mother called, to speak just specifically about my personal experience related to this topic, I know that my mother called the treatment facility that my brother had been released from on his behalf, but because of HIPAA wasn't able to speak to someone. So, you know, that is always tricky in terms of navigating it as a family. But I also know that my brother called on his own behalf, but there wasn't really anyone to call, if that makes sense. You can only call the treatment facility that sent you there, but there's no hotline or no place to call to say, I'm unsafe here, I need a different placement.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It certainly sounds like that would be something to consider as you move forward with this task force. So I applaud the effort. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Okay, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers and Representative Adelson for bringing this. I'm so unfamiliar with this particular model of service, sober homes, you know, and maybe there's a reason for that, that we don't license them, as why you have the bill. But I'm just curious, in the language of the bill, I think it does say something about looking at the sources of funding, but does public funding go toward these with through housing support, or just, you know, curious about if you know if the state or the federal government are doing some of the funding?
Who would like to respond to that? Chris.
Madam Chair, Representative, not typically. Typically, sober homes are private pay. And we're all familiar with what used to be called Rule 25, the county funding to go to treatment, which actually I'm a product of in 1998. And they provide treatment monies. They don't provide housing. There are some wiggle room there. Some of the counties, like Dakota County Emergency Assistance for any type of housing, will pay for sober living. But by and large, it's private pay. And can I just also speak to the fact that there is actually a lane for complaints, and there's an ethics committee as part of MASH, the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes. We take complaints all the time. I'm chair of that committee, so I actually answer them. And I can speak to what kinds of complaints and how many and all those kinds of things. And that's been in place for many years. And I've been running. I have a dozen sober houses myself, St. Paul Sober Living, for about 17 years in Colorado and Minnesota, and I can be happy to answer anybody's questions, or you can look me up and email me, and I'm happy to clarify anything you don't know about.
Okay, Chair Liebling. Okay. Is there any other?
And Madam Chair, I was just Representative Liebling. We have involved DHS. They've been in the conversations as well, and they also have, in terms of concerns about not having this license or regulated and some of the funding mechanisms. So we are definitely paying attention to that issue.
Okay, thank you. If there's no further discussion, Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 3537, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3537, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. We're going to go back to House 53093 and Representative Richardson. So, Representative Richardson, we have a House File 3093 back in front of us. I need to renew my my motion to move the A20-0688 amendment. Members, do you have any questions about the changes? Okay. Representative Freiberg.
Wasn't there an oral amendment too? Oh.
So, Mrs. Carcress, can you? There's an oral. There was an oral amendment. Can you please explain the oral amendment?
It's
So, Madam Chair and members, on page 4, line 16, delete everything after bias. And page 4, line 17, delete hemorrhage. This updates the title to make it conform with the text of the amendment.
Okay. Anyone, do you have any questions on the explanation? So the chair would like to move the oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Thank you. So, let's see. So with that, the chair moves again the A20-0688 author's amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Richardson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The United States spends more than any other country on hospital-based maternity care. However, we fare worse in preventing pregnancy-related deaths than most other developed nations. In recent years, the high maternal mortality in the United States has gained significant attention. The most notable disparity in maternal mortality rates in the United States are defined by race. According to the Centers for Disease Control, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than their white counterparts, one of the widest disparities based on women's health in the United States. To put the scope of this disparity into focus in relation to other health disparities, a Black woman is 22% more likely to die from heart disease than a white woman. A Black woman is 71% more likely to die from cervical cancer, but 243% more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes. Every pregnancy-related death is tragic, but what is so devastating for families that have been impacted is the reality that approximately 60% of these deaths are preventable. 3 out of 5 of these pregnancy-related deaths could be prevented. This is not a new phenomenon, and this unacceptable disparity has persisted for decades. The disproportionate toll on Black women is a leading contributing factor to the reason that the U.S. maternal mortality rate is so much higher than other countries. What it is also very important to understand is that when you control for age, general overall health, educational attainment, and socioeconomic status, we continue to see these disparities. So this means even with social and economic advantages, Black women remain at higher risk to die during pregnancy and childbirth. A contributor to these disparities is the reality that bias is embedded in our medical system. House File 3093 is designed to begin to address these persistent and unacceptable disparities in maternal mortality. The first section of the bill requires hospitals and birth centers to implement evidence-based implicit bias training for its personnel that care for women who are pregnant and postpartum. The Department of Health would be required to monitor for compliance for the implementation of these programs. The second section of the bill would expand studies to include maternal mortality and maternal morbidity. Like maternal mortality, severe maternal morbidity is increasing. Severe maternal morbidity is associated with a high rate of preventability, similar to what we see with maternal mortality. It is considered a near miss of maternal mortality because without identification and treatment in some of these cases, these conditions would lead to maternal death. Identifying severe morbidity is important to preventing mortality. The bill relies on the mortality, on the definition of morbidity set out by ACOG and the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, recommending that facilities have a screening process in place to detect potential cases of severe maternal morbidity, which includes transfusion of 4 or more units of blood to a pregnant or postpartum woman, or admission of a pregnant or postpartum woman to an intensive care unit. This screening process is an important step in promoting safe obstetric care.
Thank you. You have any testifiers, any other testifiers? Or? Okay. All Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Brittany Lynch Wright, and I am getting ready to read a part of an article that I had published in Insight News last week. Also, that is Zora Wright, who is the inspiration behind this bill also. Kara Johnson, age 39, was a successful entrepreneur who spoke five languages. She was a mother of a little boy and was looking forward to welcoming her second son into the world with her husband. Sadly, during the delivery of her second child, a scheduled C-section, Johnson's bladder was nicked and she suffered internal bleeding. 12 hours after her son, Langston Johnson, was born, Kara passed away. During the 12 hours between when her son was born and when she passed, she and her husband pleaded for help from the staff at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, but their concerns weren't followed up with sufficient action. Blood was reported to be in her urine at 5 p.m., but an OBGYN wasn't notified to help until after 11 p.m. Johnson's husband, Charles Johnson IV, pleaded with staff, noticing that the concerns of his wife were being ignored, to which he was told, "Sir, your wife is not a priority right now." At 12:30 a.m., Kara Johnson was taken back into surgery, and by 12:22 a.m., she was pronounced dead. The internal bleeding caused her body to go into hemorrhagic shock. The bigger picture is that the heartbreaking story of the Johnson family is merely one in 700 that takes place every year here in America. Despite this growing trend in the United States, the World Health Organization reports that the majority of birth-related deaths are preventable. For black women, the chances of dying during childbirth are 3 to 4, sometimes reported as 3 to 5 times higher than any other group of people in both the United States as well as in the United Kingdom. Black infants are 2 to 3 times more likely to die during childbirth or in the first year of life than any other group of people. America has had more infant and maternal deaths of any industrialized industry in any industrialized country in the world, but it's not due to a lack of qualified healthcare professionals. It is not due to a trend in health deficiencies within the birth mothers. The primary factor that indicates how high a woman's chances of passing away during childbirth is race, with non-Hispanic African-American women being the most at risk regardless of socioeconomic status and pre-existing medical condition. Black infant and maternal mortality is a public health crisis created by implicit and explicit bias within the medical system. It is medical professionals and institutions failing to listen to, understand, and acknowledge the concerns of their black female patients in the same way that they treat non-black patients. The American Public Health Association declares this a violation of several human rights, including a mother's right to life, the right to freedom from discrimination, and the right to health and quality health care. The American Public Health Association recommends that these violations of human rights be addressed by federal, state, and local government entities, as well as their partners. I came here today and have chosen to testify on this particular issue because I gave birth about a year and a half ago. I'm born and raised here in the Twin Cities, and when I was about 7 months pregnant, my husband accepted a new job in Boston, Massachusetts. This meant that in order for us to move, I would have to, within my third trimester, find an entirely new medical team to provide care for myself and my unborn child. When I got to Boston, recognizing the public health crisis that was happening for mothers who looked like me, I spent weeks not receiving the care that I needed because I was trying to Google and find which institution was the least likely to let me and my baby die during childbirth. That's how I spent the third trimester of my pregnancy, not nesting, not buying a crib, not preparing for the biggest thing I have ever done in life in the next chapter and being excited. I was in fear that the medical institution that I chose wouldn't listen to my concerns. And I was completely healthy, had no complications my entire pregnancy. But given the statistics, there was a really high chance that either my daughter, myself, or both of us wouldn't make it. And so that's how I prepared for my life as a mother. recognizing that the slate was stacked against us, not just to have a quality of life, but the possibility that we wouldn't be able to live at all. I didn't want to be Kira Johnson. It didn't matter how successful I was, how great of insurance that we had because my husband had a great new job. It didn't matter any of those things. All I knew is that there was nothing I could do to change the color of my skin and make the medical professionals who are paid to just treat us, to listen to my pain, and to honor my body. And this is not something that is isolated because I happen to move. This is the experience that Black mothers have all across this country because we don't feel safe in medical institutions in one of the biggest moments of our lives. I would not be here with an obnoxious toddler disrupting everyone's day unless this was absolutely something that was important to me and that I want to see more people take notice of. As a result of the Black infant and maternal mortality, people think that, oh, once you make it through childbirth, you're safe. In Kira's case, she was still in the hospital when she hemorrhaged and she passed. But there are a lot of mothers who give birth and are discharged and pass away after giving birth because they are not given the proper postpartum care that they need. So what ended up happening for me is because I recognized I made it through childbirth, and so did my child, but because I was not given the proper postpartum care that I needed and I experienced lots of complications, I ended up moving back to Minnesota away from my husband, whom I love, so that I could get more support here in the state of Minnesota because this is where my friends and my family and my community live. And when we moved out to Boston, we didn't have similar support. And so we had to take drastic measures to shift the way that our family operates just so that I could be monitored and supported because the medical facility in which I gave birth, in which our insurance company was well paid for, didn't provide the postpartum care that I needed, and my health was at risk. So that is why I'm here. Thank you for your time. I will shortly remove my toddler. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. All right. Is there any other testimony from the audience? All right. Members, any questions? Representative Edison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill, and to your testifier for her what she's saying. I remember reading about the disparities within simply based on your color. I know, Representative Morrison, as an OBGYN, you probably are well versed in this. But your testifier said, listen to our pain. I remember talking to some medical students and their surprise when they heard from some of their senior physicians that Black women report pain or feel pain differently. And they're just being shocked. And so while we don't think these things happen or we don't see them, it does happen. And I thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I echo that. Representative Richardson, thank you. And, you know, we get such a great education in these committees. We really do. Sometimes this is quite the issue. I do have a question about the bill in the definition of morbidity that you mentioned this in your testimony, includes the transfusion of 4 or more units of blood. That's, boy, you got to be really sick to have morbidity under this bill. I mean, that's pretty, right? I mean, I don't know a ton about, you know, postpartum medical issues, but that just seems like it's a high level before you call it morbidity under the bill. Could you just talk about why you picked that level?
Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the purpose for focusing on that was to really encompass the severe maternal morbidity that both ACOG and other similar medical-focused organizations had done quite a bit of work in terms of defining maternal morbidity. So it was really relying upon the ACOG definition.
Okay.
Chair, thank you. Thank you for that. And of course, Representative Freiberg just, of course, pointed out too that it's or admission to an intensive care unit. So this is, you know, high level morbidity. But I mean, I guess, I don't know, this is, morbidity is being defined here just for purposes of this bill though, right? I mean, because that just seems, I don't know, it just seems like, boy, somebody's got to be really, really sick to be, to count under this bill. And I'm just not fully understanding why that decision is made.
Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, in terms of thinking about maternal morbidity, typically how it's being discussed with ACOG and other organizations is thinking about it as the near misses, as the individuals who, but for intervention at the right time, could have also died. So the definition of morbidity from the ACOG perspective, we're talking about very severe situations.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, so there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 3093, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 3093, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cantrell, House File 3907. Welcome, Representative Cantrell. So the chair moves House File 3907 be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. Representative Cantrell, welcome back to the committee again. I see that you have an office amendment, so the chair will move your DE1 office amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and Representative Cantrell, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be able to present House File 3907 before you. Right now, federal law allows for federally qualified health centers to share in savings that are generated through the 340B prescription drug program that was established by Congress in 1992, which basically outlines a requirement for pharmaceutical manufacturers to provide outpatient drugs to eligible healthcare organizations or covered entities such as federally qualified health centers at slightly reduced prices. Now, as federally qualified health centers serve the most disadvantaged and vulnerable populations, the services that they provide and any savings that they're able to either turn into more services or turn into reduced costs or greater availability of services for patients can be the difference between the continuity of care for patients and potentially a patient not receiving those services, unfortunately. So as it stands right now, there is not a process in Minnesota through which Minnesotans who are part of the medical assistance managed care population to receive these 340B savings through federally qualified health centers. And what this bill does is it essentially requires all the stakeholders, the FQHCs, the commissioner of the Department of Human Services, to get together and try to evaluate the feasibility of a process through which these savings may be implemented and through which a system may be arrived to where these savings are able to be passed on directly to patients who are part of that managed care MA population. Madam Chair, with that, I'm going to turn to my testifier, Mr. Ackert.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Members of the committee, my name is Danny Ackert. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent Minnesota's 17 federally qualified health centers, or referred to as FQHCs. and we collectively treat the primary medical, dental, and behavioral health care of 200,000 Minnesotans annually. House File 3907, as amended, requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop a process to invest available 340B drug rebate program savings into patient care at FQHCs in order to increase access to comprehensive primary care and increase access to significantly discounted prescription drugs within the urban and rural communities they serve statewide. Federal law governing the 340B rebate program allows 340B covered entities, including FQHCs, to share in medical assistance savings, or MA savings, generated through the 340B program by serving managed care Medicaid patients. Per federal law, 340B savings are intended to be invested in increasing access to patient care and increasing access to discounted prescription drugs as a way of leveraging scarce federal resources. As Representative Cantrell mentions, there is currently no process in place to allow for available 340B savings to be invested into FQHCs and their patients. House File 3907, as amended, provides the opportunity for the state to develop such a process by determining the best practices for the following. One, the use of 340B managed care or use of 340B for managed care Medicaid patients served at FQHCs, the development of a point of sale identification system at contract pharmacies to prevent 340B duplicate discounts, and to develop a process to share 340B savings with FQHCs. Further, the current system does not keep 100% of available savings in Minnesota because Minnesota must return the federal MA match on MA drug rebates. The proposed process to be developed through House File 3907 would keep 100% of available 340B MA savings in Minnesota and directly invest it into patient care and underserved communities statewide. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I thank you for your time and I urge your support for House File 3907. And also with that, I stand for any questions.
All right, thank you. Is there, you can just wait for, there for a moment. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3907? Okay, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cottrell. Can you tell me any idea about, like, estimates in terms of how much savings this could generate?
Okay, Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ellison. Our part of the process would to develop this process would be to generate a more precise number for you. Our best estimate from talking to our members and the community health center statewide that we believe this is over $2 million annually in savings that are currently unable to be invested into community health centers.
Representative Edelson. So thank you for bringing this, Representative Cantrell. So Mr. Eckert, I know you met with me to try to explain this to me and I still find it pretty confusing. I'm just, so am I misstating this, that what this does is it basically funnels to the FQHCs funds that currently come to the state. It allows the FQHCs to capture money that otherwise would go to the state. Am I misunderstanding that? And then just to be clear, could you just explain, and the other piece of that is that then the state also under this bill has to develop some systems to make sure that there's no duplication of payments. But then how does this look for the patient exactly? Or does it change what the patient experiences or pays?
Mr. Hacker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, to your first question, right now, for managed care Medicaid patients, 340B is not available to them. We're asking for it to be available to them. And so we would be carving in FQHCs and through that carve in to the Medicaid rebates through 340B, those savings per federal law would be, are intended to be invested into covered entities. And in this case, for patient care, direct patient care at community health centers. To the patient, the 340B program all happens kind of behind the scenes, the benefits to the patients remain the same. This is just money flowing differently, using the 340B regulation and subtext to ensure that, or to make it available that these savings can go directly to the community health centers. And I would also just add that I think 340B is a quintessential example of how complex healthcare can be.
Well, thank you, because I was looking around the room and I was going to say, I hope you all understood his explanation, because I did not.
Right.
So I think, you know, as we think about whether to give this bill a hearing in finance, I think we're going to need to understand this a whole lot better, because it's not just, it'll be one thing to just get a fiscal note on it, but another thing to kind of understand how this thing works, because you're right, it's really complicated. All this is complicated. But but anyway, for purposes of this committee, you're saying that patients would experience nothing different? You know, either the patients that go to the FQHCs or, oh, and I want to make sure, you said something about the carve-in, and so FQHCs in some way are going to be considered managed care entities, and does this affect then anybody else but FQHCs?
To answer, I think I'll answer the Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. In order to develop the process, we do need to coordinate through the study with the managed care organizations and the contract pharmacies that are participating in 340B with the covered entities, with the community health centers. So I think that generally there is impact to reorganize so that the savings can be invested as intended. Why we're not asking for the process to be implemented in this bill is because we want to be able to measure four times before we cut once. And this language is agreed on with the department, and we're going in hand in hand with that. And to answer your first question, sorry to back up, with managed care patients, it's for managed care Medicaid, in which the 340B program allows for those savings to be drawn down to the covered entities. So again, to the patient, there's nothing the patient has to do differently. They go get their care, they can get their specifically discounted drug. Again, it's the organization on the back end with the covered entity, the contract pharmacy, and the state, so that we can remain in compliance, so that the benefits of 340B are not jeopardized, because they do provide a significant resource to patients to access discounted drugs when drug costs are so expensive.
Well, Mr. Acker, I'm sure there's an easier way to explain this, but in order to have an opportunity to hear it in finance, I would have recommended you do a visit to Chair Liebling and maybe some visuals, because you're putting a lot of entities together to explain this thing.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I will. Yeah, if I disappear, it's because 340B has forced me to go away.
So there's any other questions? Okay, seeing none, the Chair renews a motion that House File 3907, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 3907, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to HHS Finance. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to House File 3801, Representative Freiberg.
Chair Moran, I move that House File 3801 be recommended for placement on the general register.
All right. Thank you. So do you have a testifier before you? I think you moved the bill already. You have some, you explained the bill.
I can.
Just to explain the bill.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to bring House File 3801 before the committee this afternoon. As many of you know, the medical assistance spend down, also known as the excess income limit, has long forced thousands of people with disabilities deep into poverty, requiring them to pay their own medical bills to cover the gap between two different standards. This unfair gap between the income limit and the MA spend down will finally be eliminated in July of 2022 due to advocacy efforts that have spanned the past decade. This bill is a no-cost and policy-only proposal that will simply clarify the spend-down reform we passed last year. It inserts a cross-reference to the appropriate income standard, which is a better approach than duplicating the language. There are two key benefits to us fixing this language now. First, by using a cross-reference to specify the standard, we fix the 2019 change that inadvertently omitted a reference to the Supplemental Security Income Standard. And second, keeping the existing language would leave us open to another spend-down gap if the income limit ever shifts, meaning another long and drawn-out fight to readjust the spend-down. I'd like to introduce Rebecca Preston, who's a citizen advocate with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance and a constituent of mine as well.
All right, thank you. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rebecca Preston. I live in Golden Valley and have lived with a brain injury since 2005 when I was T-boned by a drunk driver. I struggle with a cognitive disability which keeps me from being as organized as I want to be. I'm thankful for the CADI waiver through medical assistance that I have been using for the past 14 years. This allows me to have an independent living skills worker who helps me organize my apartment and interpret my mail. Before my brain injury, I was an avid reader and read 2 to 3 books a month, both fiction and non. Today, I can't remember the beginning of a story by the time I get to the ending. It makes me sad to think about all that I have lost, but it's really important that I can remember that really important for me to remember that I can advocate for a better life for people with disabilities. Here is my financial situation. I receive $1,134 a month from Social Security Disability. I also receive $500 a month from a special needs trust, which is a trust that I do not own, but the funds are used on my behalf. After my rent, spend down, and bills are paid, I'm left with about $300 to pay the rest of my bills. The first time in 14 years, I'm living in subsidized housing, where I pay a third of my income for rent. I realize that not everyone is as fortunate as I am. Part of the problem for me living in poverty is that I'm unable to choose where I live, what I wear, how I get around, or what I eat. I just do not have the funds to choose. I am so grateful for the spend down reform championed last year. I'm counting down the days to July 2022, when I finally will be done paying this huge spend down. This bill improves that reform even more. Please show support for people with disabilities and vote yes on House File 3801. This bill will add a cross-reference to make sure we never have a gap between the income limit and the spend down. Please make sure I never have to worry about paying an unfair and burdensome spend down again. It is very important that I become part of society and control the way I spend my income. We can never be equal until we can keep more of our own money. Balancing this budget should not take money out of my pocket. Please don't say that you stand for people with disabilities. Show that you do by voting for the policies we ask for. Thank you so much for your time and listening to my story.
Well, thank you so much and being so clear about what you want. Appreciate it. And for members, if you look, if you just need looking at line of the bill on line 1.15, the specify in subdivision 4, there's a a document in your folder that references what the eligibility requirements are for medical assistance. So thank you so much. Anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 3801? Members, do you have any questions? Okay, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg, and thank you to the testifier. I just wanted to say I think the bill's just fine, and we should absolutely pass it. And I just wanted to say that I'm really just so glad that we were able to do the spend down change. It's a long time coming. It, it just was never fair, but it was too hard to, it was too hard to get it done in the regular budget, which is why it's out to 22. But I'm so glad we were able to do it. And anybody who voted for the Health and Human Services omnibus bill last year voted to change the spend down. So delighted that we were able to do that. And thank you for being here to advocate. And you were just terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg, you have anything? Okay. So there'd be no further discussion. Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 3801 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and House File 3801 is recommended for placement on the general register. We're going to go to Representative Schultz and then come back. Okay, House File 3223. So I understand you have an office amendment, Representative Schultz.
Yes, I would like to make a motion to re-refer the House File 3223 to Health and Human Services Finance Division and move the A1 author's amendment.
Thank you. So Representative Schultz moves the A1 author amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
Yep.
The motion prevails. And Representative Schultz, please present your bill.
So members, Madam Chair, House File 3223 is the bill that will hopefully increase competition in the biosimilar biologic market. Right now, there is no competitive market for biosimilars due to rebate traps, rebate walls, and formulary exclusions. These practices are anti-competitive. There needs to be an even playing field for biosimilars and originator biologics. The use of rebates provides incentives to PBMs to steer patients to costlier branded biologics rather than cheaper biosimilars. Today, biological medications account for close to 40% of total prescription drug spending in the U.S. And in the last 5 years, brand name biologic drugs accounted for more than 90% of prescription drug spending growth. In 2018, the U.S. spent $126 billion on biologics, less than 2% of which was on biosimilars. In Europe, there are over 45 biosimilars that have been launched with discounts of up to 70%. In the United States, the FDA has approved 26 biosimilars, but only 11 have launched, usually 35% below the price of the originator biologics. So I have one testifier, and I just want to quickly tell you what the amendment has done to the House File 3223, which passed with bipartisan support out of the Commerce Committee. So this file tries to provide parity for biosimilars and the reference biologic products by requiring equivalent coverage. This will greatly reduce patient risks and inefficiencies in the provider market and eliminates barriers to using biosimilars, which are cheaper than the originator biologics. The amendment adds an effective date of January 1st, 2021, and mandates a study to look at prices of biosimilars and biologics after this bill is enacted, if enacted. So right now I'd like my testifier to be introduced for the record.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is David Spurl. Thanks for having me today. I'm a pharmacist at Essentia Health. I'm from Duluth, and I'm here with my colleague Roseanne Hines, and I'm honored to be offering testimony on our behalf. So today we're asking for support of House File 3223, a bill that allows providers to prescribe biosimilar products in a manner that focuses on patient safety and also helps drive down the cost of prescription medication. To orient you to us, Essentia Health is an integrated health system serving patients in Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Idaho, and we're headquartered in Duluth. We have 14,500 employees in our 77 clinics, 15 hospitals, and 7 long-term care facilities. As the committee considers this legislation, I'd like you to imagine that you're a patient who has debilitating joint pain or a new diagnosis of cancer. Your doctor, who you know and trust, discusses the various treatment options with you and prescribes you the medication that's not only best suited to treat your condition, but also the most affordable for you. Understandably, you would want to get this medication started right away. After getting your prescription, you now find out that because your medication is a biosimilar medication that isn't covered by your insurance company, your treatment's delayed and your doctor is forced to prescribe a different biologic that's covered by your insurance company. Although this new medication is clinically exactly the same as your original prescription, it's far more expensive and requires you to pay more out of pocket. Finally, imagine that once you get the medication that is covered by your insurance, you find out that in changing your medication, your doctors prescribed the wrong dose due to the confusion caused by the complexity of switching medications as required by your insurance. Unfortunately, this is the reality that our doctors, other healthcare providers, and patients live in every day with the class of medications called biological medications and the related biosimilars. Biosimilars are a new class of medications that offer no difference in safety, purity, or effectiveness when compared to their brand biologic medication counterparts. These new biosimilar medications offer significant opportunity to drive down costs, much like generic medications have done for years. Despite all of this promise with biosimilar medications, as demonstrated in the patient scenario that we presented today and discussed by the Institute of Safe Medication Practices, there are various safety concerns regarding the current payer-driven system for prescribing and dispensing biosimilar medications. For example, in the current system, to satisfy different payer requirements, a healthcare provider must stock or ensure it devotes significant resources to stocking multiple inventory and multiple option or multiple versions of the same medication, all of which that are functionally the same, which adds unnecessary waste and complexity to the system. Due to the volume of different medications, there are increased risks with the physician prescribing the wrong medication or the pharmacy dispensing and administering the wrong medication or dose. This bill, through requiring insurance coverage parity of all brand biologic and biosimilar medications, will allow doctors and patients to choose the medication that's the most effective and brings optimal value for the patient. As Representative Schultz said, the biological medications are one of the most significant drivers of prescription spending in the U.S. Yet the current system set up by medical and pharmacy benefit managers and pharmaceutical industry brand manufacturers has limited the ability for patients to benefit from these new medications. At Essentia Health, we continue to work hard as an accountable care organization to provide high-value care that reduces the overall cost for our patients and their care. We've worked closely with the physicians at our organization to review the biologic medications and their associated biosimilars, and we actually use these medications many times every day. Unfortunately, due to the different payer restrictions, not all of our patients are able to realize the savings that they could with these biosimilar medications. And so, as Representative Schultz said, there are currently 26 of these biosimilar medications that have been approved and less that are actually on the market. So with only a handful of these medications available, it's understandable that this issue may not have yet garnered the attention of some more well-known issues. This year, however, is slated to be a year of exponential growth in biosimilar medications, which is why we believe it's important today to continue the efforts to facilitate the use of these biosimilar medications in a manner that focuses on patient safety and lowering costs overall for patients.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Just real quick, because I think I've heard you say several times that doctors are prescribing the wrong medication. Just how common is that?
I wouldn't have an exact statistic for how common it is. We know that as the Institute of Safe Medication Practices lays out, that's one of the primary risks is when you add additional complexity. Because these medications are all named very similarly with just a little change to the end of the name, it causes the risk and complexity for providers. And there have been many documented cases of patients being harmed due to this issue nationally.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Schultz, you have another testifier?
Right.
I don't, but I believe there are other testimonies. Do you want it? Do you want it?
Yes.
Okay.
I was on it.
Oh, okay. So is there Michelle Mack? And Max Schaefer. So welcome to the committee. Ms. Mack, could you please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a Director of State Affairs at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA. PCMA is the National Trade Association representing America's Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs, which administer prescription drug plans for more than 266 million Americans with health coverage provided through Fortune 500 employers, health insurance plans, labor unions, and Medicare Part D. PBMs are engaged by clients to manage pharmacy benefits pursuant to health insurance benefits and contracts. PBMs only manage pharmacy benefits that occur in the prescription drug benefit, so any prescription drugs given in a hospital setting are not covered under the prescription drug benefit, but under the medical insurance plan. I'm here today to provide our perspective and respectfully testify in opposition of House File 3223 in the form that it is today. We met with the bill sponsor, Representative Schultz, and applaud her stated goal to use this legislation to increase the use of biosimilars and thus decrease the cost for consumers. Increasing competition in this evolving market can surely lead to lower costs to Minnesotans. The PBMs were a longtime advocate in supporting the federal law that was enacted to grant the Federal Drug Administration the ability to create a framework under which granted the Federal Drug Administration, or I'm sorry, to create a framework under which biosimilars and interchangeable biological products can be approved. The passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 gave the FDA the authority to move ahead, and we support in the increase in development increase in development and use of these drugs. As we have evaluated the language in House File 3223 that is before you today, it appears that the author's goal of increasing the use of biosimilars and lowering costs to consumers may not be achieved. As we interpret the current version of House File 3223, the language appears to expressly limit PBM tools, such as formulary development and management, as well as prior authorization, specific to biosimilars. This effectively hamstrings the PBMs and plans where these tools are needed the most. This bill appears to create an open formulary for biosimilars and biologics. While there are currently no interchangeable biosimilars on the market, there are several biosimilars, and each year this list grows. I should add that these types of drugs are the largest growing segment of the market, which makes it even more important to get this right. These types of drugs, while they may only account for 1% of the utilization, represent 50% of the cost. We appreciate the language in the author's A1 amendment to add study language to evaluate the impact of this legislation after the bill has become law. And we would recommend, however, that it might make more sense to conduct this research and analysis on the front end to determine the intended and unintended consequences on all stakeholders impacted by this bill. I appreciate the committee's time and attention to our concerns, and we will continue to work with the bill's author and bill advocates on the language. Again, we applaud Representative Schultz for looking into this and would suggest getting further information on the matter to find ways to improve biosimilar competition. Thank you, and I can take any questions you may have.
All right, thank you so much. We want to go to, we have two more testifiers, and then we can ask questions. Matt Schaefer and Judy Cook. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am Medica's government relations team, though today I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the Trade Association for Minnesota's 7 nonprofit health plans. We'd like to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to get our concerns on the record regarding House File 3223. During the presentation of the bill, what we heard from the proponents was they do want to see an expanded use of biosimilars on the market, and we'd like to see the same thing. When considering the average wholesale cost of a biosimilar is about 35% lower than a brand name biologic, Couple of examples you can find is for one brand name biologic that is used to commonly treat arthritis. It's currently on price for an average wholesale cost per year is $62,188. Another brand name biologic that's commonly used to treat cancer is close to $70,000 per year. So the addition of biosimilars to the market is something we want to see because we're commonly asked for negotiating on costs. But it's unclear to us whether the language in 2.4 through 2.9 accomplishes that legislative intent. We're concerned that that language may inadvertently leave the door open for a carrier to be required to cover a higher priced biologic if prescribed by a provider, even in the instances where the medical evidence would suggest that a biosimilar would be more than appropriate. We understand the concerns brought forward by the proponents, and we're happy to work with them over the interim, and as there might be some opportunities for collaboration. However, we are concerned that the bill as written would translate into increased costs and higher premiums. We do appreciate the author including the study, though much like previous testifier indicated, we would recommend a cost-benefit analysis on the front end. The other piece I did want to close on is I was looking at some of the letters of support that were put in support of this bill. And while I can speak on behalf of my health carrier, I did get some feedback from our pharmacy team. And essentially what they gave us was to respond to some of the concerns about how formularies are assembled. Our formulary does include FDA-approved biologics and biosimilars for every type of medical condition in need of these products. And when a patient needs a medication that is off the formulary, we can make an exception. When there are multiple biologics and biosimilars indicated for the same medical condition, we are hoping they can compete to be on the formulary based upon patient outcomes as well as the cost. Now, as folks have indicated, this is a very new science. There's 26 on the market right now. We're hoping there will be a lot more. But I want to get those concerns. We want to get those points on the record. And that concludes my testimony.
All right. Thank you so much. Ms. Cook. Welcome
to the
committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates. I represent the Association for Accessible Medicines, the Association for Generics and Biosimilars, including their division, the Biosimilars Council. We very much appreciate the sponsor's intent of bringing biosimilars to market via parity with biologics. We're still struggling a little bit with the language because we're not quite sure it accomplishes that goal. As other people have said, savings from biosimilars are being lost as a result of barriers to adoption, which actually can occur at the provider level. But we do want to continue to work with Representative Schultz on language that would provide preferential treatment for biosimilars that would increase availability in the market. It's very exciting to hear all the support for biosimilars from hospitals and PBMs and plans. We're very eager to bring them to market. For information, biosimilars are projected to save as much as $54 billion over the next 10 years. The information I have says that in the U.S. there's 14 of the 26 biosimilars that have been approved. 14 are on the market. In Europe, there are 50 on the market. They've been using them since 2006. The slow uptake in the U.S. is due to rebates that are used to protect market share, legal hurdles such as patent thickets and acceptance, which it does take time, just like it did with generic drugs, for patients and prescribers to understand that biosimilars are available and effective. And I would just say that despite significant price discounts, few of the biosimilars have been able to get market share. We also appreciate Representative Schultz's efforts to assist hospitals and their desire in this to encourage adoption and use of biosimilars. But our records show that according to CMS, biosimilars administered at hospitals are on average 25% cheaper than their branded counterparts, but many hospitals do not currently stock biosimilars. We're concerned that this legislation, as drafted, will permit hospitals and other providers to stock only the biologic, which could have a lower cost to the hospital after rebates or other bulk discounts that the biologic would provide, and so would not actually create the parity that is desired. We appreciate the study after a year and want to continue to work with Representative Schultz and see if it's possible to come up with language that would accomplish the goal that it seems everybody has, which is to bring more biosimilars to market. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify on House File 3223? Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some concerns here, and obviously, particularly with the goal of bringing down the cost of the medications. However, share the concern that this bill does not accomplish that. And really, the red flag to me is in the amendment where medical assistance and CGIP are exempted from the program. And that's a red flag to me that would incur a significant cost to the state if we didn't exempt those problems. Is there another reason that the state programs would be exempted?
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative New. So because there are so few biologics and biosimilars, there was concern by the agency that we may not be able to generate a fiscal note without disclosing proprietary information on the rebate structure. So I wanted to avoid that by excluding our public programs in case we couldn't get a fiscal note. But when we do the study, we can look at our public programs and what prices we get in that market compared to the non-public program, non-CGIP market, and the data from the All Payer Claims database to look at price variation.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. It seems logical that we would do the study before enacting legislation. This seems like a really, frankly, bad way to legislate. I'm concerned about that. And I do agree with the testifiers. The formula, and again, nobody here is an apologist for the high cost of medical care and the different organizations that make money here along the way. However, formularies, obviously, the providers take a great deal of care in making sure that those formularies are providing low-cost options to the consumer. And by making these changes before understanding and studying, that seems to be moving backwards here. That seems to be doing this in reverse order. I will not support the bill today. But I would support a study, certainly, moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative New. So we will have the data from before the bill is implemented to see before what our prices, list prices, net prices, and then after. So we want to do the comparison because this bill, the intent is to drive market competition among the biosimilars. So we could do, we are getting information on the current prescriptions of biologics and their prices, and we're being informed by many hospitals, and many hospitals are stocking biologics because that's what's being reimbursed by the PBMs and health plan carriers. So it doesn't look like there's enough competition among the biosimilar biologic market today. And that's why this bill is coming forward, to inject more competition in the market. So that's why, but we would have, we'll look back and see over time what's happening to the prices.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That actually makes it more concerning than the language in 2.4 to 2.9 that is going to change this. You know, so we'll have the data, but the language will be enacted regardless of what that data shows.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative New, we want to look at the effect of the bill. So right now we know that prices are high and we're not using biosimilars. They're not being reimbursed because of rebates or other discounts on other drugs if they list a certain biologic rather than a biosimilar. And so what's the impact the intent is to improve competition.
Mm-hmm.
So if we see prices falling, as we should with this bill, because equivalent coverage allows hospitals to stock biosimilars rather than just formulary biologics, they're paying an equivalent coverage, meaning the intent is they're not paying more. They're paying what they would have paid if they used the stocked biologic. So that hopefully will give an incentive to hospitals to stock something cheaper below the biologic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I understand the concept, certainly. I just don't think the language necessarily provides for that.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. So I also want to ask a question about how it works with carving out the state programs. So I understand your concern about giving out proprietary information, but it seems like the information we're concerned about is the amount of the rebate. For example, if the state under sub 1.22 prefers a biologic because they get the larger discount in the state programs for the biologic, and then the state keeps those discounts, that's what we're not knowing, and so we won't have that data to understand the effect. Am I not understanding this?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, so
yes.
The data that we would be using is in the All Payer Claims database, so we would be able to identify the payer and the price. So I believe we will be able to get that information and compare that market to the what the hospital's prices are and reimbursement levels.
Representative Robbins.
Because they both report into the All Payer Claims database.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That helps, but I'm wondering, is that why we're not getting the fiscal note? Because we don't want to reveal what the state gets for the rebate on biologics and what the state gets reimbursed and what that savings is?
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, and so thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. So it'll be aggregated. So when the report comes out, it'll just be aggregated data information looking at whether prices went down. So we wouldn't be releasing information on from the public program.
You good? Representative Robbins.
I'm sorry, ma'am, one more follow-up. But if the state chooses to continue to only use the biologic reference, not the biosimilars, because they're not covered by this bill, we won't see any change, correct?
Representative Schultz.
I can't comment on what sort of contracts they would get with their PBMs or health plan carriers through our public programs. I would think that they would also benefit when there's competition in the biosimilars, and they'd be offered similar lower prices for biosimilars than the biologics.
Thank you. All right, thank you. So any other questions? There being no further discussion. So Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 3223, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails, and House File 3223, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to Health and Human Service Finance Division. So members, I need your help here. So we have two bills left over. Representative Freiberg bill, which is House File 3199, and Representative Edelson bill, which is 3485. Both of these bills have contents around medical marijuana. Freiberg has another hearing in another committee, and so the thought was, if you like to, we can hear Representative Freiberg that we now break for an hour and then come back at 6. And we need to break because the hearing this afternoon, we have a group of individuals who would like to be here who need special assistance. So we cannot have that hearing until 6 o'clock.
And they're only here on the Representative Edelson's bill, right? Okay.
Yes. So I guess my question is, for those who would like to stay, maybe we can say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those who would like to recess until 6?
Aye.
Let's move on. Representative Freiberg, why don't we hear House File 3199?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Have we settled?
Okay. For your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
I will move House File 3199 be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Services Finance Division. I also have a DE1 author's amendment that I would like to move.
Okay. So Representative Freiberg moves the DE1 author's amendment. Representative Keel.
Keel. I have a A1 amendment.
Okay. So Representative Keel would like to offer the A1 amendment to the amendment. This is to the DE office amendment.
So we need to we're past the adoption here first.
Okay. I'm hearing it could be either or. I think it goes either way. Why don't we adopt the DE1 amendment, and then we'll come back to the A1 amendment. So all in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The DE1 amendment is adopted. Okay. Okay, so let's do a presentation, then we'll come back to the A1 amendment.
Sure.
Okay.
First of all, thank you, members, for your indulgence here. I do have a bill up in Pensions Committee shortly, too, so I'll probably be back here for the other bill, but this will make it a little easier. Fortunately, it's on a very non-controversial topic, the topic of cannabis, okay. So it should go very quickly. I'm kind of kidding, but I do think, actually, this is a fairly very narrow provision within that issue. So I was contacted a few months ago by a constituent of mine who receives railroad retirement disability benefits. Now, right now, the fee to enroll in our medical cannabis program is $200. However, certain individuals, if they receive Social Security disability insurance or supplementary security income or medical assistance from Minnesota Care, they're entitled for a reduced fee of $50. My constituent was not receiving railroad retirement disability benefits, was not entitled to that $50 fee. So. I agreed to, it seemed like a very analogous situation to what the people who were entitled to the fee, so I introduced a bill to fix that issue. Around the same time, the legislative auditor came out with a report showing that there were several people who received the lower fee from the Office of Medical Cannabis, but they weren't statutorily entitled to that lower fee. So one of the options that the legislative auditor suggested was just to make it clear in statute that they are entitled to that into that lower fee. So it seemed like a very analogous issue. So and the Department of Health had already prepared some language for it. So the amendment, the DE amendment that we adopted, just expands it and clarifies that provision as well to make it consistent with the recommendation in the legislative auditor's report, and as well as would help out my constituent. So I don't have any testifiers on this. I believe the department is here if there are any questions, okay. And they can answer them.
All right.
I know Representative Peel has the A1 amendment, and I've reviewed that and would view it as a friendly amendment.
Well, let's go to the A1 amendment. Representative Peel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Freiberg. This amendment, Representative Freiberg talked about the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, so I don't need to go through that, but we want to make it very clear that the list of groups who can pay the reduced fee are finite, and all are listed out here in the statute. If MDH wants to offer a reduced fee to additional groups, they will need to get the legislature to agree. This amendment ensures that MDH must collect $200 from any individuals except for those listed in the statute. This should help address the finding of the OLA that MDH charged some patients the wrong registration fee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Keogh.
Representative Freiberg.
Okay. As I said, I view it as a friendly amendment. I would encourage members to support it.
So, is there any discussion at all on the bill, on the A1 amendment and the bill, on A1? Yep. All right. So why don't we move the A1 amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Okay. The A1 amendment has been moved and approved. And so, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3199? Do you have any questions for members? All right. So, there being no further discussion, Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 3199, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 3199, as amended, is recommended for referral to the House and Human Service Finance Division. And members, we are in recess until 6 o'clock, and we'll meet in the Capitol Room 120. Thank you. All right, we're going to reconvene the Health and Human Service Policy Committee. Before us, we have our last bill of the day, House File 3485. Representative Edelson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would. House File, I would like to move 3485 to be re-referred to Health and Human Service Finance Division.
Okay, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do have an A1, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Edelson moves her A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and Representative Ellison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so that everyone is aware, the author's amendment removes the delivery vehicle sections of the bill. It removes the manufacturer mobile distribution. We have a little bit more work to do on that, and so we didn't want to hold things up. House File 3485 is a pretty... there's only two parts of it. It's adding raw plant to the medical cannabis program, and it also removes the qualifying. What it says is it's enough if you have terminal illness. It's enough if you have cancer to be a part of the program. Right now, there's all these qualifiers in addition to chronic wasting and things like that. So last year, we had passed through the House some changes to the medical program. What we know about medical cannabis is that it's a great program that works for many patients. We have, 19,000 patients and 1,700 docs. And we've seen that graph has kind of gone up as time has gone on. More people participating in the program and seeing value. But one of the biggest feedback that people hear on this is, or will, they will give to the manufacturers and to advocates, will be people say, and I'm sure that we'll have some testifiers tonight, is that it's really expensive. Insurance does not cover it. And people are paying out of pocket. Last year, we heard some testimony that some of the patients are taking on second jobs to afford their medicine. So, Madam Chair, I will go ahead and move on to my testifier, Dr. Kingsley, who is with MinMed, which is one of the two manufacturers that we have in the state of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Kyle Kingsley. I'm a physician from Minneapolis. I'm board certified in emergency medicine, and I'm also the CEO of Vireo Health International, which is the parent company of Minnesota Medical Solutions, one of the two operators here in the state of Minnesota. I've been working over the last 5 years with our team of physicians, scientists, engineers, and other professionals on providing medical cannabis solutions for patients in Minnesota, in addition to other states such as New York and Pennsylvania. Just a few definitions really quickly so that we're on the same page as far as what I'm talking about here. When I talk about cannabis flower, I'm talking about the inflorescence or the quote-unquote bud. And this is the part of the plant that has the majority of the medicinal constituents of the plant. It looks like a flower. Second, when I speak of medical cannabis programs, I'm talking about the states that allow THC, not the handful of programs that are just hemp or CBD-based. The Minnesota program has successfully provided alternatives to opioids to thousands of Minnesota patients over the last 5 years, but the program remains inaccessible to many patients due to cost. This cost is driven primarily by the restrictive nature of the Minnesota program, most notably our inability to provide patients with dry cannabis flower. This lack of flower in the program has led to very low patient numbers. Minnesota, to my knowledge, has the lowest per capita adoption rate of any state with an established medical cannabis program, and this is despite the fact that the program has been up and running for nearly 5 years. Fewer patients means that we have high fixed costs of processing technology and overhead that need to be distributed across a relatively small number of patients. These high prices are keeping patients out of the program, which keeps prices high. And many patients feel that the illicit market is their only option to obtain flower, which is far cheaper than what is currently available in the medical cannabis program. Illicit market products are not tested for contamination or purity. Sick patients who resort to the illicit market for relief due to economic reasons are at risk of pesticide and other dangerous chemical exposures, in addition to being part of an illegal drug transaction. Despite these risks, we believe tens of thousands of Minnesotans that have qualifying medical conditions are buying in the illegal market because of the lower street prices. Adding regulated flower products to the program would provide an immediate benefit to patients. We estimate that many patients will be able to access the same level of medicinal plant content for approximately one half to one third of the cost, because medical cannabis in flower form doesn't require the extensive processing that the oil products require. As is the case with other medical cannabis states that use flower, these flower products would still go through the same safety and potency testing as our current products. These more cost-accessible flower offerings would almost certainly lead to thousands of patients that are currently buying cannabis on the street, coming out of the shadows and enrolling in the state program. As more patients enter the program, it's highly likely that the prices of many products will drop, not just flower, because our fixed production costs will be spread across an ever-growing patient population. This is very much not a hypothetical scenario. Other states have moved from pure oil-only models to flower, and have seen their programs grow substantially as prices fell. This is what happened in Florida, Pennsylvania, and other states. Today, to my knowledge, Minnesota is the only flower that does not allow any only program that does not allow any form of flower in the medical cannabis in its medical cannabis program. If Minnesota were to move forward with flower, it would be with the support of the world's largest 24/7 adverse event call center, Safety Call International, based here in Minnesota. They would be monitoring closely adverse event management and doing post-market surveillance, looking for side effects and complications. I know there are questions about the health impact of consuming dry flower. Flower may be consumed by various methods, but the most common and most often concerning for healthcare practitioners is the combustion or smoking of the flower. Evidence of any harm must be taken into context when considering the risks of the patient's underlying severe illness. The alternative medications, such as opioids, which the patient may be taking. What is reassuring is that, unlike smoking tobacco, decades of research and centuries of cannabis use have not linked cannabis to lung cancer and some of the other ailments seen with tobacco use. In fact, for many years, the only form of federally sanctioned cannabis actually produced in a federally sanctioned program was flower form from NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and the University of Mississippi. This federal program has since been expanded to include oils and other forms of cannabis for research. Widely held and patient-reported belief is that the benefit of smoking the whole plant whole plant products provide more relief than isolated cannabinoids, a belief referred to as the quote-unquote entourage effect. A growing body of evidence supports this notion that the clinical effectiveness of cannabis in various medical conditions is improved when the many terpenes, flavonoids, and other components of the plant are utilized by patients. About two-thirds of patients prefer administration by inhalation, either vaporized oils or smoking, over other routes such as oral administration. Inhalation reduces the latency to onset of action relative to other routes of administration, so patients can feel relief much faster. I always bring up the individual dying of pancreatic cancer at the end of life. They're able to titrate within minutes to pain relief versus taking pills where you're waiting 90 minutes or a few hours, and you stack multiple doses, and then all of a sudden it all hits you at once. So it's pretty remarkable medicine in that it works so quickly, and patients are able to very quickly titrate to relief. Inhaled forms, interestingly, here in Minnesota in the form of oils, are responsible for the lowest number of calls to our 24/7 adverse event hotline. Actually, the oral and kind of more traditional pharmaceutical type products result in more calls to our event hotline. In summary here, and I appreciate everybody's patience, given the real dangers of current prescription opioids, the current inaccessibility of the program due to cost for many patients and subsequent use of illicit cannabis, the frequency of pesticides and other adulterants present in cannabis flower that's purchased on the street, and our expansive track record of safety in Minnesota and beyond, it's my opinion as a physician with real knowledge of the cannabis space and multiple state medical cannabis programs, that the benefits of utilizing cannabis flower substantially outweigh the risks across our patient population. Similar to vaporized oils, we will strongly encourage at-risk patients, those with lung issues, for example, to utilize a different form of cannabis, such as tablets or topical applications. Our licensed pharmacist will continue to supply extensive counseling to each patient and will strongly encourage controlled vaporization of the flower over quote-unquote smoking. Close follow-up with each patient on a regular basis, as is mandated by the state currently, will continue, and we will continue to use our post-market surveillance program with all patients. This is a safe and responsible way to lessen suffering for our patients while maintaining an excellent record of no significant adverse events. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have a couple of other testifiers listed. Joan Barron. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Joan Barron. I am currently enrolled in our medical cannabis program. I am testifying in support of HF 3485. Our son became addicted to my illegally prescribed opiate medications. Our son overdosed and ultimately died from legally prescribed opiate medications on October 22, 2014, at the age of 29. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But I'm also someone that lives in horrific pelvic pain nerve. The main motor and sensory nerve, the pudendal nerve, was damaged in a fall in 2001. Since I've been enrolled in our program, it's made possible for me to go for longer walks, attend a concert, and most importantly, I am able to be more present with my family. Prior to that, I was curled up in bed, in the dark, alone most days. If we can give Minnesotans an affordable and a safer alternative to opiates, why wouldn't we? Why aren't we? If medical cannabis would have been in my cupboard instead of bottles of pharmaceutical opiates, I believe my son would still be here. My son did not go from cannabis to heroin. He went from FDA-approved opiates to heroin. There are doctors cutting patients loose after 20-plus years of managing their pain, leaving them on their own, forcing them onto the illicit market for their own pain management. I have lost friends in support groups because of suicide, because they cannot get adequate pain control due to the opiate epidemic. All of them were in states that did not have medical cannabis programs. We have a medical cannabis program that is drowning in debt, while hundreds of thousands of potential qualifying patients are unable to access it because they cannot afford it. We need raw flower added. This is the only way we will reduce cost, and all of you know that. I want to share one more reason why I'm personally affected by the cost of our program. My only living child, my daughter, is up on the seventh floor at the University of Minnesota. Right now, I just left her. Last Sunday, she was rushed into emergency surgery, and she had a perforated bowel. My 39-year-old daughter had to have all but 5 inches of her colon removed. My daughter has suffered for over 7 years with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, but the cost of our program has been so expensive, she hasn't even been able to try it.
Beans, it was a dirty surgery. She has had complications of contaminated fluid buildup. We currently have a program that she can't access due to cost. Please add flour to our program. I'm sure you're tired of hearing my story, and I know for sure I'm tired of telling it. Add raw flour to our program. Thank you.
Thank you so much for testifying.
Thank you. Carrie Sheldon.
Hi, for the record, my name is Carrie Sheldon, and I am opposed to this bill because, number one, I am sick and tired of having to smell it everywhere I go. It really makes me sick. I've been in pain for 52 years, and not once have I ever been offered marijuana. There's a lack of other kinds of medications that I'm not able to even take, so I have to live in pain no matter what. And because of the lack of PCA care, I have to smell every single day of marijuana because everyone has to smoke it, and there's no reason for it. There just isn't. Because I've been in pain for 52 years, it just doesn't make any sense to even have anything like that and to make everyone else suffer. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3485? Is there any discussion from members? Okay, Representative Baker.
Close enough. Thank you, Chair. My question deals with, you know, if we're allowing plant material, what risk would that cause for, people who use it? What type of risk is associated with that?
To the testifier.
So, like many things in cannabis, there isn't the most expansive data. And, the one thing that we do know about cannabis in its flower form is that it's been used for centuries. And the data that we do have demonstrate that you don't see the incidence of lung cancer and things like that that you see with tobacco smoke. This may be due to some of the anti-cancer properties of the cannabinoids themselves. That being said, as a physician, I would be a little nervous about those with pulmonary illness, reactive airway disease, COPD, et cetera, utilizing cannabis in smoked flower form. Now, one thing that most people don't realize is that you don't have to burn cannabis flower to utilize it. You can actually vaporize it. Generally speaking, a rule of thumb is that the higher temperature you use, the more problematic it can be because you're going to generate a lot of problematic compounds. So vaporizing cannabis, just warming to the point where the cannabinoids evaporate versus burning the flower material is one potential path for patients. But our MO, similar to oils that are currently vaporized, is that if you have pulmonary illness or something that precludes or makes it less likely to make it less helpful for you to inhale it, we'll refer you to capsules or topicals or some other form of cannabis. So I know that was clear as mud, but there are always potential risks. If somebody uses cannabis for 50, 60 years, can I say that there's zero risk to that? I cannot. What I can say is using cannabis in lieu of opioids is generally a pretty good idea based on our experience to date here in the states in which we operate.
Thank you.
That's it.
Members? Okay, Representative Dr. Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an age limit to participate in the medical marijuana program?
Okay, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is, I don't think there, you maybe you would know, but I do want to mention an amendment that we are working on that we will be bringing up at HHS Finance that will be dealing with this program, the flower
specifically requiring that you have to be 21 and older to vaporize the raw plant. But for the actual program, I don't know. You could speak to that.
Yeah, currently there is not, and we do have a large number of pediatric patients, many epilepsy patients or terminally ill children that access the program and with generally positive results.
Representative Dr. Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So right now, we're removing some of the stipulations for use. So without the amendment in place, we are saying that a 15-year-old with a diagnosis of cancer who has a great prognosis and 100% cure can start smoking marijuana under this bill.
Would like to
Is
respond.
That true?
Representative Edison or Dr. Kinsley?
I'll let you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mann. That's why we need to do the amendment because we unfortunately didn't bring it today because we missed the timeline and Chris knows, Mr. McCall knows I was trying to get that added to this, but it will be coming in HHS finance. I mean, I think all of you as members know that I really care about youth and their access and making sure that we're protecting youth. Medical cannabis is something that patients have usually tried 2 to 3 different medications before they've come to using this program, but we obviously want to make sure that we're protecting youth.
Okay. Is there any other discussion? Oh, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson. I have a couple of questions. You had mentioned that some similar states had moved from more of the oil and all of that over to the flower form, and that had helped bring down costs across the board. Two questions. One, I'm looking at this raw cannabis comparison chart, and maybe I'm missing it. Is the cartridge the flower?
The cartridge is oil.
Dr. Kinsley?
I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. So I guess I'm curious because I don't see the flower listed on the chart here and how that would...
Madam Chair, Representative Bonner, what chart are you looking at?
The Medical Cannabis Program in Minnesota Program Information
was that a member's
sensible
packet?
Change.
Oh, here. There we go.
If you can give me just a second here.
And I understand it's not on the chart, but perhaps you could speak to where the flower might come in comparison to some of these other forms?
Absolutely, yeah.
Just give them a moment to review the chart, and you can respond.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, it looks like, you know, obviously flower is not here because we don't have flower in Minnesota. What I can say is per active milligram, the price for a flower is substantially lower. So essentially for the same amount of medicine, the same amount of bang for your buck, you're going to, it would be less than half the cost here. There's a lot of kind of flex in those numbers. There's economies of scale. If you have a very small little amount of flour, the savings are less substantial. But we anticipate with the influx of patients that we'd see with these more accessible options that we'd be looking at half the price or less for flour options.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. And so I guess the overall question around cost would be, do we have an idea in some of the states who have converted? I mean, what could we expect to see an average savings from the current forms that we have available compared to what the flower would be?
I'm comfortable. I'm sorry. I'm very good at parliamentary process here. So, I'm very comfortable saying that a patient would be able to access the same amount of medicine for half the price or less if they use flower form in lieu of one of these other forms. That's a very safe statement. It may be much more substantial than that. Our main experience is in Pennsylvania, where that's proven to be less than half of the cost, and many patients have gone that path.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So one other question that came up here, and I'm just curious about this because I honestly don't know the answer, but there was some conversation around smell.
And obviously with the flavor, or the flower, excuse me, we would be using, I think the primary method for delivering that is some sort of a vaping device or something of that nature. Is there any way to speak to whether that would be a concern? Is that moderated by that option? I'm just, that's a curious mm-hmm. question.
Madam Speaker, actually, if I could just,
Edison.
Yep, Madam Speaker, Representative Bonner, this would actually also be covered under the Clean Indoor Air Act. I did double check on that, so I do appreciate the testifier. In terms of what someone does in their own home, though, how they medicate, I find that very challenging. How do we ever regulate that? Dr. Kingsley, if you have something else to add.
Dr. Kingsley.
Yeah, so a lot of the things that make cannabis smell the way it does are terpenes, which are part of this purported entourage effect. And so some of the therapeutic benefit may actually be tied to that smell that you smell. And so if you're planning on inhaling it, it's really kind of hard to control that just as a matter of practicality. But similar to secondhand smoke, it's important that we, you know, control that issue.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I promise this will be my last bit, and I will be done. First, I just wanted to say thank you, Representative Edelson, and thank you for being here. I've talked to a lot of patients about this specific topic, and in fact, I ran across a couple in my district and had talked to a woman who had said she had suffered for decades from really terrible pain. Had not been able to participate fully in life with her children, with her grandchildren. And her husband sitting next to her, he said, you know, this was a game changer for us. He said, you know, we talked about this, and their daughter works at the University of Minnesota in pharmacology. She teaches. And when she recommended it to them, at first, you know, the idea, she said, you want me to do what? You want me to smoke? She thought, you know, that's crazy. And she said, Mom, you know, there's oils, there's different methodologies here. And she decided to give it a try. And she said, you know, I have been able to sit on the floor and play with my grandchildren. She said, I haven't been able to do that in over 20 years, not even with my own children. You have a husband who's saying that he got his wife back. You know, and I have to say that when I've talked to folks in my community, one of the things I've heard a lot about is that they really appreciate the idea of the medical program, but their worry is that it's difficult to find someone to prescribe it. It's difficult to find a dispensary, and it's expensive. And so I do think that being able to do something that would help bring down the cost substantially could really help a substantial number of patients. And it is, in most cases, a far more acceptable format than an opioid. And so I'm actually really grateful that you brought the bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative New. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm quickly running through the bill, and I'm not seeing it right now. But Representative Adelson, would it be legal under this to smoke cannabis in a vehicle?
Representative Adelson.
Is there any prohibition on that?
Do you know what other people are doing? Madam Chair, Representative New, I guess I would have to look into that and follow up with you because, I mean, I don't know how you would. You think about hands-free driving that we just passed. You and I were on the floor for that. How are you going to do that hands-free? So I don't necessarily know how you would do that. I think there's many factors that would go into that. And actually, no, just let's pause for that. Is it legal to drive a car while you're high on opioids? No, of course not. This doesn't change that. If it's a mood-altering substance, whatever medication it is, of course that's not legal, and we wouldn't change that in this. So correcting my answer mid-thought.
Representative New. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it seems like we actually don't really have a good answer, but I might suggest doing an additional amendment to clarify that, because we would want to make sure that while we're legalizing a new substance, that we don't inadvertently cause problems on that front. And my next question is on that same line of questioning. Do you know where law enforcement is on this bill?
Before you respond, Representative
Addison, I want to let Ms. Carvis respond to your question. Representative New.
Madam Chair and Representative New, in section 152.23 of the medical cannabis program, it prohibits the use of medical cannabis while operating, navigating, or being in actual physical control of a motor vehicle. Thank you.
Okay. Now, can
Representative New, can I ask for clarification on that, Madam Chair? Thank you. Can you clarify, does that state that you cannot be under the influence of medical cannabis, or you cannot actively use it while, or actively partake of it while you are driving a motor vehicle?
Ms. Carvis.
Madam Chair and Representative New, it says possessing or engaging in the use of.
So you could be under the influence of.
We never would know. No, Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly right. We would never know because there is no roadside test for marijuana in the blood. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative New, I'd be happy to add a slight clarification. We could maybe add on to the piece that already addresses it in one nature. We can add a little clarification on that, sure.
And I would just like to maybe just, you know, I remember this debate when we were debating about this concept around legalizing medical cannabis, even in this current form. And we would have parents who would show up with their children who was dealing with epilepsy, right, that was out of control, and they have tried everything. Children were not functional at all, right? And eventually, they was going to other places just to get what they knew would help their child function every single day, and found out that it really minimized the number of or acts of epilepsy, right? And because of those stories that we heard, that it wasn't about them trying to be high or individuals thinking of, it's for a medical reason. Right? This is not a joy drug. It is really for medical purposes in very extreme cases when there are extreme pain and other issues are impacting people's lives. So I just want us to kind of like remember that we was having the same type of thought processes as we was going through the whole, you know, legalizing of medical marijuana. One moment, please. And so I just want to share that with the body, with the member and the folks in the audience, that the impact that medical marijuana has had on individuals' lives, that is so much beyond an enjoyment of it because, you know, they want to enjoy it, but it really is for a medical purpose. And so on that, I would like to...
Madam Chair, may I finish my second question?
Oh, I thought you was done. Okay, Representative New.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I did ask another question about law enforcement.
Madam Chair, Representative New, I have not heard from law enforcement, and this is out there, so they have not expressed any concern about this. I know that there was concern when this bill was initially passed in 2014, but as of now, no, I have not.
Okay, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I've been... post-traumatic stress in particularly our veterans groups, I've been working with them since I've been in the legislature here. And I'm wondering, did I miss something here? But it's one of the groups that I'm really concerned about affordability. And this is where they told me it would work. Is that, have you focused anywhere on that either?
Dr. Kingsley, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. I can tell you that we've, you know, again, anecdotally, I've seen dozens of patients that are veterans of foreign wars with PTSD. Almost universally, there's some, you know, PTSD seems to go hand in hand with lower socioeconomic status, ability to pay premium prices for medical cannabis products. I would say of all the groups that are out there, this is one that would be most disproportionately affected in a positive way by having access to flower. And I also say, you know, just anecdotally, that it's a group that does access routinely the illicit market to access this flower versus the more expensive oils.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, so that intrigues me that we're basically putting these soldiers in the line of illegal activity when we could really, because I heard the same thing you did from people, that this is the way they access it, through illegal means, and they gave up a lot. And if we can help them in any way, my dad was a disabled vet, and I know what these families are going through. So this is really, Representative Adelson, this is a good bill, and I hope we can get this through.
Madam Speaker, you know, I actually apologize. There is another testifier. I don't know if we could possibly still hear from her. I just got a message that she's here.
Yes. Is she here?
Erin. Yes. Erin. Okay. Yeah, yes. We'll keep it short.
Please come to the testifier table. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you to the members of the committee. My name is Erin Chase, and I am also a patient in the medical cannabis program. The primary reason I'm here is to express my support of this bill. Most of the people that I've talked to who are other patients also express that affordability is the primary concern. I'm one of those. It is very cost prohibitive as a patient. I think the program ought to allow for raw flower simply because it would lower the cost for us patients. If you look to other states like Pennsylvania, prior to 2018, they only allowed oils and other extract forms. And then amidst demands of patients who are struggling to afford this, they reversed course and allowed for flower to be introduced. Consequently, local publications have noted that cost have been cut into half, much like Kingsley has stated. The day that I received my intractable pain certification was a day of joy for me. I spent the last 12 years dealing with symptoms from ovarian cysts, endometriosis, PTSD as a result from domestic violence, as well as two herniated discs I got from working three service industry jobs in college. There were days that I felt so nauseated, so in pain, I couldn't get out of bed. I had to skip classes. I had to miss shifts at work. This program has been a lifeline for me. It's been an answered prayer. You know, there isn't many options available to treat chronic pain outside of opiates. And after losing one of my childhood best friends from an opiate overdose in 2012, that isn't an option for me. I refuse. That is not a path I want to go down. Unfortunately, that elation of being introduced in the program quickly subsided after visiting some of the pharmacists when I found out that feeling my best would cost almost $500 a month. It doesn't make sense to me. You know, when you visit other states that offer reciprocity to us patients, I can go and get a month's supply of flower for $100 to $150. That's crazy. It's infuriating. I've done everything I possibly can. I followed all the rules. I stayed out of trouble as a kid. I went through college. I worked three jobs to put myself through graduate school. I got a corporate job, and I have benefits, and I still can't afford this program. It's outlandish. You know, as a result of putting myself through college, I have monthly student loan payments that could easily pay for a $400,000 mortgage payment at today's rates. I don't have extra cash to be paying, you know, more than $500 a month for this program. It doesn't make sense to me. I have to make the choice between paying down my student loans or seeking treatment in this program. And consequently, most of the time, I have to choose to put that money towards the Department of Education. This isn't an option for me. You all here today have the power to change this, to make this program work as it was designed to do, to help the most vulnerable Minnesotans get access to the care they so desperately need. I just encourage you to act not from a place of fear, but in the best interest of your constituents, because I am one of them, and I am one of many who really need your help today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there any other questions from members? Representative Backer?
We're good.
Okay. Representative Pinto? All right. Since there's no other, and I just want to close with this. You know, we talk often about access to affordable health care. Medical marijuana is part of health care. People are in extreme pain. And this is a pathway to help those and to make it affordable. I just want us to look in our package that talks about the medical cannabis program in Minnesota. I'm going to read that. As of Friday, January the 3rd of 2020, there were 18,398 active patients enrolled in the program and 32,059 patients approved to date. Over 13,000, that's over 40%, patients have dropped their enrollment in the program since the registry in 2015. And much of that is from the unaffordability. And so Minnesota has received a C for its medical cannabis program from American for Safe Access, which is one of the lowest grade awarded in the country. If we're going to be serious about medical marijuana, I think this is our opportunity to do so. So I want to thank you, Representative Edison, for bringing this bill forward. I want to thank Dr. Kinsley for coming to testify. And I too hope that we don't live from a place of fear, but from a place of access to affordable health care. In this instance, it would be medical marijuana. And so since there's no further discussion, Representative Edison renews her motion to House File 3485 as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and House File 3485 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. I want to thank you all so much for coming back this evening, and we are adjourned.